Welcome to CI, Confronting the Issues, bringing a progressive faith perspective to the issues of today. And we're live from the San Francisco at the Leon T. Company in the Lower Polk neighborhood. And welcome to this holiday edition of CI, Confronting Issues. Happy holidays to all of you listening out there. We're glad that you're able to join us today. And on this holiday edition, what we've decided to do is to kind of pick up the threads from some prior shows, especially our Veterans Day program, which turned out to be one of our most popular. And then we'll also be exploring the kind of increasing vitriol in the religious right speech, especially the Psalm 109 movement, which really calls for the ouster and actual death of an ungodly leader, and what has happened to the public discourse lately. But first, as we look at picking up the threads from the Veterans Day program, I'd like to introduce my first guest, who is coming from the Boston area, and he is Michael Anthony, one of the youngest authors to come out of the war in Iraq, and he wrote a book called Mass Casualties, A Young Medic's True Story of Death, Deception, and Dishonor in Iraq. And I read this book and could not put it down. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran, and if I had changed these names and places, it could have recorded my service when I first went in too many years ago to think about. And so, Michael, would you like to tell us, take a minute and tell us about what you're doing now and a little bit about your book?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Well, what I'm doing now is, you know, since writing the book, I've just been going to school for creative writing and working on some other projects, and I've been working a lot with veteran groups out there to try to deal with veteran PTSD and veteran suicide, and I just met up with some psychologists where we're working together on a book about post-traumatic growth, which is helping veterans with PTSD, not only to help them out, but also get them to turn those experiences into something good where they can help out other people. And what I tried to do with Mass Casualties was I had seen, coming back home, I had seen all these statistics going on with, you know, veteran PTSD and veteran suicide and homelessness. And I had read all these books and seen all these, you know, news coverage and media coverage, and I didn't see the connect between, you know, these statistics that were going on and everything that was being told. You know, there's a book I had read about the initial invasion of Iraq, and it's this great story about, you know, all this American heroism, but the story ended right there. What a lot of people don't know is some of those characters that the book are based on, they actually came home, and a lot of them killed themselves or kicked out of the military for drug use. And I just didn't see there was just so many gaps that I saw between, you know, the stories that are being told and where they end versus, you know, what happens a year or two later with, you know, the veterans. And what I wanted to do with Mass Casualties was just fill in the gap and explain how some of these statistics come about.
Well, I can tell you the book was compelling. And one of the interesting factors of the book, which we'll get into in a little bit in more detail, is the fact that it's really told from a support soldier's point of view. And a lot of the books we read are from combat soldiers, the trigger people, who are outside the wire, to use the vernacular of our present-day wars. And most of our soldiers are actually support soldiers. We have a big tooth-to-tail ratio in our military. And so it's very refreshing, disturbing too, but refreshing to get a point of view across from a support soldier, especially from a medical unit whose job is to take care of the wounded, who really feels the pressure not only of the battlefield outside the wire, but all the associated positives and negatives inside the wire and inside the hospital. Also joining me today in San Francisco is the Reverend Dr. Darrell Clemens. He's a retired United Church of Christ pastor. He is a psychotherapist and a social service specialist, and he's also a member of my congregation that I go to at First Congregational Church. And I probably should disclose that while I'm seeking ministerial standing in the UCC, he is my advisor at the congregation, just so you know the relationships that are clear here. But, Daryl, would you like to take a moment and tell us a little bit about your practice?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to make a connection with Michael, whom I was really fascinated to hear about. I just saw your book, Michael, just a couple minutes ago as I arrived here with Risha. And I perused it very quickly, and I'm excited about reading it. I check the chapter headings, and I see it's a journal. It seems very exciting. And I have some connection with what you're talking about because I had worked at 29 Palms Marine Base as a family therapist dealing with Marines who were being deployed to Iraq and also Afghanistan, and then also dealing with post-traumatic growth or post-traumatic stress reaction when they would come back. But at any rate, I'm really invested in reading your book now, and I'm excited about the fact that somebody like yourself, particularly as young as yourself, not to be ageist about this, but to have seen somebody who was a support soldier writing such a book. I wish you well on that, and I will certainly read it, and I'm hoping to do some dialogue with you as we go along. I would like to say also that I have been a professor of psychology, sociology, and religions of the world, and as a psychotherapist, I have dealt with a lot of drug abuse and military domestic violence in particular, and I have also been a social service specialist, having worked in domestic violence and all kinds of social work, including hospital work and agency work and that sort of thing around the country. So I'm hoping we can do some dialogue as we move along here.
Well, I really look forward to a great program here. Also, one of the things we deal with here in San Francisco is parking. So Daryl will have to get up and leave occasionally to feed the parking meter because our meter Marines are out in force and they are active. So one of the issues that came up during our Veterans Day program was among the clergy that we had there was the idea of some kind of ritual for returning warriors or returning soldiers. And this is apparently a practice in many ancient cultures that there were cleansing rites. And even in the early church, there appeared to be rituals or liturgies, and as we would call them in our Christian tradition, that deal with the returning warrior to help prepare them for their transition or reentry into civilian society, and also to welcome them home and to just let them know they are welcome and there's a community ready to stand with them as they readjust to a different world. And one of the things I'm very curious about, especially for you, Michael, as a person who is not, you're not training to be clergy, you're not a lay leader necessarily at a church, is to get your feelings and opinions about that, whether you think it's useful or not, or you think it's something that might help a number of men and women as they return from Iraq and Afghanistan.
A ritual definitely would just be something great to help them. You know, for us coming home, one of the things that happened was, you know, it's all mandatory that we have a post-deployment health assessment, which is PDHA, which we all meet with a psychologist. What happened is you go and you meet with this psychologist, and there's a line of the whole unit. You know, there's 100 people waiting in line. And you go in and you talk to this psychologist, and basically what happens is, you know, they ask you all these questions, if you're depressed, if you're going to kill yourself or not. What happens is if you say you are depressed, you are, you know, thinking about suicide, the 100 people waiting in line behind you are going to know that you're the one that's messed up. What happens is everyone else gets to go home, and you have to wait there and stay and go through all these tests and, you know, go through all this therapy and stuff like that. So, I mean, basically the only thing that we had coming home was, you know, someone going in asking us how we're doing, and if we say something's wrong, everyone in our unit's going to know that we're the one that's messed up, and we won't get to go home because we'll have to stay there and do all these tests. So, I mean, I think there definitely would, you know, everyone would benefit from some type of ritual rather than the nothing that we get right now.
I mean, I look back to my own return, which was many, many years ago, and we basically, in 24 hours, We were sitting from a rice paddy or fire base or whatever, and then we're sitting in our parents' living room, and we're expected to, you know, live and adjust and be like it was when we left, because all of us were stuck in memories that were a year old. My memories of my hometown and home were when I left a year before. My parents' memories of me were a year before. So there was this expectation that was grossly unreal. And when I think back on it, the lack of having just some kind of welcoming or some kind of even sanction that, you know, we understand you had to do things that are uncomfortable, that stretch your morality, that maybe put you in conflict with your own feelings about God or morals, and that, you know, we understand that. We're here with you to not only help be channels of forgiveness, but of love and acceptance about that, to help you stand with you as you adjust. So I thought it was a pretty good idea. Daryl, some of your thoughts on that.
Well, I have been involved in awareness of debriefing after service and having been deployed. Marines in particular have been deployed for so long, and then making that rapid transition back into the country and also into the family. One of my concerns has always been the preparation of the family to receive, as well as the serviceman or woman to re-enter into life as it is. It's not unusual to compare that to the whole issue of people who go away to rehab or treatment for drug addiction or so, and have their own forms of traumas, etc., and their own form of disconnection from life as it was. In fact, people who are alcoholic or so tend to stop their emotional growth at the height of their addiction. So there's a lot of catching up to do, and I compare the reentry type of process from the trauma of war to the reentry that people have to make back into the real society when they have been traumatized by street warfare. I see a lot of people around San Francisco that I regard as survivors of urban warfare, and that a lot of the dynamics of trauma are the same, and the length of time that is needed for that healing process and that readaptive process to go on. And it just simply is not enough help.
I think, Michael, could you tell us a little bit, if you're comfortable, talk a little bit about your own experience, and out of that, what you think for you in returning might have been most helpful from family, neighbors, the people who are closest to you?
I mean, definitely, I think it is a big issue, too, you know, to have family members ready to receive the returning veterans. Things like that do go both ways, where people are trying to put their lives, you know, back in order. You know, this person has been gone for a year, now they're going to be back in their life at the same time you've been gone for a year. And for me, one thing that definitely helped coming back home is definitely having a strong, in general, one thing that really helped was having the strong family support thing. One thing that I had talked to a lot of soldiers, and one thing that has helped soldiers overall with coming back home and having a sense of purpose. While you're over there and you're fighting the duty, you know what's going to happen every second, every day. You know what your job is. You know what you're going to be doing. You know what you're there for. And coming back home, you just don't have that sense of purpose, because now everything's up to you, especially for those soldiers that were in the reserves. Now you're coming back home, you go back to civilian life, and there's just such a disconnect, strong purpose. One thing that really helped was family members coming back home and, you know, just giving you little things to do, where you just have this more of a sense of purpose, where, you know, for me, I focused on the book, and that helped give me a sense of purpose. And I had my family members supporting me in writing the book and sharing my stories and getting out there and talking with other veterans. Family support definitely is a big thing for me. Have better time to follow their new purpose.
Yeah, I think that it's also kind of an under observed or underappreciated aspect is the preparing a family for the return, because as Daryl just said, the family's relationships, dynamics change, the perhaps the wife who is you know, left behind. Now she's assumed the responsibility of paying the rent, that kind of stuff. Maybe when her spouse was home, that didn't happen. We have more women deployed and their husbands, so we have male military spouses now. So another change in dynamic. So I think preparing them for the change is as important as the veteran, because it all plays together. It can't really be separated.
Right. I'm really picking up on the sense that the unsettledness in war and also the immediate preparation for anything that happens at any moment, and knowing a daily schedule and fitting that and doing it and being pretty well trained and also operative in that kind of environment. So one then, as a soldier, moves from intensity to a sedentary lifestyle back home, possibly finding themselves sitting around, waiting for the next shoe to fall, and anticipating hearing noises, being prepared and ready. It's almost like the returning soldier is suffering from excitement addiction, and that life is not as exciting, and the job is not there, and then the families many times make the mistake. I mean, how do you welcome back a young man that you knew as a high school athlete or so, in the family, dating, doing those kinds of normal things, and now he comes back? He may have been a killer, he may have been highly traumatized, he may have hallucinations of sound and sight in his mind. How do you deal with that? Because families have a tendency to treat a returning person, no matter what they're returning from, in a way in which they had treated them before they left. And this must be incredibly agonizing and confusing and anger-producing, I would think, as well, that people have not taken the time to really study the situation, know what's coming toward them. I keep telling people, God gave us two eyes, two ears, and one mouth. What should that say? And I would like families to really look ahead to return of veterans of wars and be able to anticipate a little bit more and do more homework in terms of receiving them back into the family.
Yeah, I think... Go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, homework definitely sounds well, because I do know returning home where, you know, big thing is for veterans where they just don't feel like people understood, you know, what really happened over there. Because when we're over in Iraq, you know, whenever we'd call home, you know, no one that I know ever told anyone back home, you know, what it was really like over there. Even myself, whenever I'd call back home, I'd say, they asked me how I'm doing, I would just say, fine. And then there'd be mortars going around and, you know, going off in the background. And they'd be like, what's that noise? I'm like, oh, it's nothing, don't worry about it, that's music or something like that. And, so a lot of times families just don't have the real story that went on behind. And I think that is a big thing for returning veterans, where they just don't share those stories. And then they come home, and it's that double entendre where they don't share the stories, but yet they come home and they feel misunderstood, or they feel like people don't understand them. And that's because they don't share, you know, all those stories that go on over there. And I think that is a big thing where we got to look towards some of the family members to do their own independent homework and, you know, find out some of the real stuff that goes on besides just what the newspapers tell.
Right, and what they hear from the newspapers and the media many times is sanitized by the government, and that they don't get the view, the world view, that the military person gets by serving abroad and also in a situation like war or its equivalent, modern equivalent. And that I just think we have to do more work with families, and I'm hoping that military chaplains and family advocacy programs and militaries are beginning to do that. I know I have addressed whole battalions of men and women regarding suicide in the military, and that we have some really serious post-traumatic stress syndrome to deal with this particular war. It is, I would think, you may agree with me, it's different than other wars that have been a lot more clear, and that we just don't get the full picture here back in the United States, and I certainly think the families don't. After all, they're busy. Sometimes wives are busy. There's been a power exchange. All of a sudden, she's taking care of everything. She's working. She's taking care of the kids. She's got a lot of power, and she's supposed to give that up at the moment the Marine or the soldier walks through the door from having been deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan, that's not about to happen. So there needs to be a lot of work with coupling as well in terms of communication and understanding what the tension happens to be. And that a lot has changed. When a young man has seen what he has seen in war, he grows up very quickly, he sees things differently, and he even has a different perspective on family. For instance, when I worked with Marines in domestic violence, I would say to them, how on earth can we trust you to protect American families when you're beating your wife at home? And what needs to change when you walk through the threshold and take off your desert fatigues and dust yourself off and re-enter into the family? What do you need to do also to prepare yourself to do that? So I think there's a two-way exchange here, and I would like to see more balance between those who are coming home and those who are receiving them home.
I think one of the things I see in a lot of this too, and I think we maybe didn't begin facing it in Vietnam, but we're probably one of the earliest generations to be in a war that was so ambiguous and vague. It wasn't the World War II. It wasn't the Grand. We weren't saving the world for democracy. Our objectives were pretty vague. Were disputed by many politically. When we come back home, there are people for and against, and this isn't a place where I really want to get into that. Our issues here are really dealing with the people who return. We sent them regardless of the rightness or wrongness. They were there. They're back among us. And so since veterans are everywhere, especially since we have part-timed this war, with National Guardsmen and reservists bearing such a heavy load of these deployments. Michael, what would be, if you could say, the top one or two things that a local community, maybe a faith community, a church, or an organization, or family, or group, could do as a returning veteran to help you with that adjustment?
Well, one of the things that I heard has statistically helped veterans out the most is something called exposure therapy, in which is basically just veterans being able to share their stories and take the time to hear other veterans' stories, which is basically veterans understanding that they're not alone and understanding other people's stories and having their stories understood. So one of the biggest things that people can do is be willing to just listen to the stories. Like they said, you know, there's two ears and two eyes and one mouth, just being there to listen to their stories and being able to understand these people. And exposure therapy, I mean, it's statistically the thing that is most likely to help veterans. It's just being able to share their stories and feel understood and take the time to hear other people's stories. And, you know people back home, you know, don't have war stories to tell. They can't take the time to tell their stories.
Yeah, I think, and it's a characteristic I've encountered. This is an anecdotal observation, that veterans often tend to be pretty quiet about their service, especially combat veterans, and who may have the most trauma, tend to be the quietest about their actual experiences. And I agree that stories have to come out, because we won't learn as a people the true cost of war, or maybe learn as a people how we can maybe not prevent the next one, but hopefully prevent one, but not be so quick to put our nation's young women and men in harm's way. But this component of listening to the story, what I've found in my experience is many times well-intentioned people, GD civilians, as we'd usually call them when I was a careerist, would ask us to talk about it, and then we'd begin, and because it was something they didn't want to hear, something horrible or something that offended them politically or whatever, they kind of cut off the conversation. Well, what that did to us is made us even more reluctant to share. So my cautionary tale to those listening would be, When you start listening to the story, it's a precious moment for a veteran to begin to tell you that, disclose that information, and you need to hear it out. Whether you like it or not, you need to hear it out, because if you don't, the likelihood of them opening up again with that kind of precious moment is very slim, and the consequences of that could be severe in his or her emotional life or the emotional life of the family. But I heartily agree with you, Michael. Do you have any ideas, Michael, on how to kind of help that process along, kind of encourage that process as communities, as neighbors, as family?
I mean, like you said, be willing. I'm right with you when you said, you know, sometimes people that have different ideologies or something like that will just jump in. They don't want to hear it. And I think that is one of the problems. One thing I've heard about my book is, I've heard a few people say that it's just TMI, which they say, it's too much information. And that really just stuns me, where it's, you know, someone's actually thinking that there's too much information about the war out there. I mean, I think there's too little information. Someone's saying that there's too much information. You know, it goes too raw into detail. It threw me back. You need to be willing to hear, you know, all the dirty details about what really goes on over there. I mean, we are fighting a war, and if we're going to, you know, fight this war, whether, you know, it's another year, 10 years, whether it's, you know, that 16-month or 18-month deadline, I mean, no matter what, we're still going to have returning veterans. We have to take the time to hear the dirty stories that we don't want to hear. I mean, when I was recently speaking to a group, and, you know, they asked me a question, you know, how come some people don't listen to these stories? And it's like, well, if I walked in here and I was going to tell you a story about one of my good friends who tried to kill himself in Iraq, you know, if I walked in and said, you know, who wants to hear a story about one of my best friends who tried to kill himself? Nobody's going to raise their hand. But if I said, who wants to hear the story about, you know, these soldiers, you know, running for their lives and, you know, doing all this, you know, everyone raised their hands. And it is that people don't want to hear these stories. And they don't want to hear the stories that they need to hear. So I think people just need to force themselves to hear all the stories that they don't want to hear.
Do you think that there's a value in perhaps, say, senior high school classes or junior college classes, where, let's face it, the age group of most of the people being recruited, they're going to be the heavily recruited by the military, gets an opportunity to listen to these stories, like the kind of the bare facts, or, you know, this is what it was like for me. And so that then they can process that with their other information and, you know, bash that against their father, who may say, hey, you know, everyone in our family served, you need to serve, and just bash it all together to make their own decision about serving or not, point or not, but also it gives you a leg up on helping them when they encounter the disillusionment that so many encounter.
I'm going to suggest something. I want to go a little bit deeper here because we're talking about people hearing. There's only a segment of a particular audience who can really hear. There's some people who need to see. There are people who need to feel. There are some that are more psychically oriented. And I think that I would encourage veterans when they come home, if they're telling their story and if they're feeling some emotion, they need to just allow that to come out. So those who see. I keep telling people that we have to see with our eyes. We have to see with our ears. See with our ears and hear with our eyes. So that when you see something with your eyes, you hear a message. And also, when you are listening, you can see something. And when you see something, you can, as I said, hear the message. So being more complete in our presentations might be helpful. Not everybody can hear the story because they're tuned into sight. Or if a veteran were to go up, say a veteran who had been disabled physically from duty and presents, the person can see. And I would encourage veterans to actually touch and make a connection, because there are those who need to be touched to make the connection as well. So we need to think of total communication when we're dealing with audiences.
The clock is catching up with us here, as it often does on this program. And so we ran into a little bit of our normal break time. But I'd like to hold that thought about the multisensory approach to telling our stories. And as we get ready and take a 4-minute break, we'll see you all back here in 4 minutes.
Multipolar inline and portable water system new from hempusa.org. Now you can restructure and degas your water supply from any source, rendering chemicals harmless to the human body by polarizing the molecular structure. Imagine a softer, smoother water with increased oxygen that helps the nervous system and brain. There are no filters to buy, and it can be taken anywhere, making it our number one new product from hempusa.org. This water system will descale all piping, hot water heaters, and appliances due to heavy buildup of hard minerals. Detoxification may result with restructured water by easily entering the fine capillaries of the human body by dissolving stones and toxins. With extreme positive effects on plants, vegetables, and fruits, improved taste, color, size, and yield with approximately 30% less water usage. There are multiple sizes also available for farms and commercial use. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. That's 908-691-2608.
And we're back live with the Leland Tea Company in San Francisco, California. with CI Confronting the Issues this holiday Christmas edition of the program, where we are picking up the threads from my Veterans Day program and talking with my guest, Michael Anthony, author of the book Mass Casualties, a very good chronicle of his experience as an OR tech in Iraq, and my other guest, Reverend Dr. Darrell Clemens, a retired UCC clergy and an experienced psychotherapist and experienced post-traumatic stress counselor, who's joining me here in San Francisco. But before we get too much further and get back into the discussion, a word about our venue here, the Leland Tea Company, and Will Otero, the owner. They are really so good at providing space for us. They take good care of us, and he is an awesome asset to this community in the events he sponsors and the different organizations he supports. He also makes the best Madeleines in the area, and I can't have a Madeleine from another source after having Will's Madeleines. And a great selection of teas. I just really enjoy this place. When they first opened 6 years ago, this became kind of a hangout of mine, so it was very natural when I wanted a venue to broadcast from that this became it. But as we left for break, we were talking about this idea of veterans telling their stories, and not just people hearing the stories, but a multi-sensory approach. There are people who respond to vision, people who respond to touch, people who respond to hearing and sight. And one of the things that I often said, and I can't speak for the experiences in Iraq, but in Vietnam I often said, came back and said, if I could only get them what it smelled like.
Yes, yes.
The smell.
Absolutely.
Now, I was mainly out in the field, but some of those places at 120 degrees, it was not pleasant. And to say it was gamey is an understatement. And so I can't speak for Iraq. I wasn't stationed there. I was a civilian in Kuwait in the first Gulf War, but I was not an infantry soldier, so I can't speak to that kind of thing, personal experience there. But certainly a multi-sensory approach. You've done a lot of speaking and presentations, Michael, to college groups and organizations. Have you done or thought about multimedia or different presentation techniques when you talk about your story?
No, I haven't specifically thought about it, but I think you guys, you know, you're right on the mark where it does have to be such a, you know, a sensory thing where, you know, where people can kind of see and listen and hear at the same time. Just, you know, the story's right from the horse's mouth. And, you know, I haven't tried anything different. I've just been going out there speaking to as many groups and people as I can, because, I mean, that's all I've been able to do right now. But, I mean, I think you're definitely onto something where it does just have to be something, you know, something more where people can just see and truly experience.
Okay, Michael, when you've been telling your story, have you had waves of emotion come over you as you tell parts of your story?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Sometimes, I mean, you know, people always ask me like how I came out so good and how I'm able to, you know, deal with it all now. And you know, I just can't help but think, you know, I'm not, you know, dealing with it all perfectly now. You know, whenever I you know, read parts from my own book or tell some of these old stories, I still, you know, get so angry and mad at some of these things. And I still haven't come to full closure with some of them, but I have been able to at least go out there and speak about some of them. And, I mean, I still get angry at a lot of the stories and just, you know, swallow that with, you know, emotion, thinking about a lot of the stuff that went on over there, even though it happened over, you know, 2.5 years ago by now.
I find it very helpful to exhibit the emotion if one is feeling that. Many times people will learn more from their experience of your emotion than 1,000 words that you can say. And that that's part of the experience, that's part of what they need to understand. And let me ask you this too. Have you had like university students come close to you, come up to you like after you present and talk a little bit more with you?
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the university students that I've met are, you know, really, really open to you know, hearing some of the stuff. I mean, just today I talked to my old high school, and, you know, a lot of the kids came up to me after. They were just really willing to hear the full story of some of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes.
Were you able to reach out to them, shake their hands, touch them, be close to them, that type of thing? I think
important. Absolutely. I mean, they all came up to me after and shook my hands. I mean, it was really a great experience to see such young kids willing to get out there and just, hear some of the stuff, from...
Right. Well, that's the kind of thing I think we're talking about here in terms of a multi-sensory kind of presentation. But if you can build that into your main presentation and not just save some of that stuff for the aftermath of those who come up and talk with you. There are others in the audience that would be, I think, just equally affected by that sort of thing. I would make sure that I move close to them, that I would walk aisles, that I might reach out and touch, that I might shake a hand, that I might incorporate them in some sort of role play about what happened to you or so, and really get people involved.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like the way to do it. I mean, one project I can say that we're actually working on with the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, we pretty much created a 4D motor attack, which is, I know if you know those rides that you go on for young kids where there's all these sounds and, the TV screens on the walls. I work with an artist, and they actually created this 4D motor attack, whereas you walk in this room and you hear sounds and, the screen's kind of shaking. It feels as if you're in a building during the motor attack. And it goes on 15-minute cycle. And we just created that to give people, one experience of what, soldiers experience in Iraq 24-7 of this, just the explosions and all the yelling and confusion that goes on over there.
Precisely.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I get out of our conversation now that I think is very important for our listeners, and I really hope any listener who is politically active or even a political leader who might be listening, is that we do a very poor job in this country of preparing our people for war. We do a very poor job of really exposing people to the cost of war, this cost, your mental cost, what it cost you when we read your book, what comes through, what it cost you, the price you paid, and it's actually the price you will pay the rest of your life for this, as many of us and millions of Americans have had to do. When I did my Veterans Day program, it struck me that I was talking with one of our guests who dealt with World War II veterans, so I was really dealing with people who had been through this from 1940s till 2009. 60 years of Americans facing this kind of trauma, and that really, when I went in, I had brothers and sisters tell me things and uncles and stuff tell me things, but it did not really prepare me for the reality of what I was going to encounter. And I don't think we do a good job of that, and I think it's reflected in the lack of care for our returning veterans. That reflects also our lack of preparing of people for the cost of war. And as I go back to, we're here December 23rd, a Christmas season, and I had people tell me this topic is not very Christmassy. I think it's very Christmassy, because Christmas is about advent or expectation, about the birth of light in a world, bringing light into darkness, and that's what we're doing with these stories. We're bringing some light into a story that's been kind of kept in the dark, and it needs to have more light shed on it so we can advance and reach some kind of positive outcomes from it. And I really want to say at this point, Michael, I really applaud your courage in telling this story and being so candid in it, and your willingness to go out to groups and share your story. It's really courageous, and it speaks of the real courage, the kind of moral courage and interior courage. It's really tough. And parents or whatever who helped influence you did a good job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, thank you. I mean, yeah, for the book, we got endorsements from Democrats, Republicans, people pro-war, anti-war people, and I think that really spoke to that people are willing to get out there and be like, listen, say, this is a real depiction of the war. This is a depiction of what really goes on. It doesn't matter if people are Republicans or Democrats or pro-war or anti-war. We've got people from every ideology and spectrum on there, psychologists and historians, and I think that really spoke to a lot of what you were saying, where people are coming together and say, you know, it's time for us to take the time to hear the real stories of what goes on.
Yeah, I think at this Christmas time, we need to take a look at that scene where high and low, rich and poor, wise men and shepherds all came together in this reception. And when I think about Christmas, I think that many times we have it wrong. We think that Christmas is all about giving. Well, God did give. However, it's really on the part of man's receiving. And for somebody to return from war and to be actually received, that, in my estimation, is what it's all about. Receiving graciously, feeling the impact of somebody coming into your life and coming back into your life, and receiving them with gratitude, with grace, and with love.
Hello?
BBSRadio.com, removing fear through communication. Engage, powerful, unforgettable. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBSRadio.com. My name is Spider Turner, and you can find my music at CDBaby.com.
Be trying to get hold of Michael again.
All right, we are live. Michael's with us.
Can you hear me? Hello?
This has never happened before.
Hey, can you hear me?
And we're back live with the Leland Tea Company in San Francisco after a little technical glitch. The gnomes were loose in our computer connections. BBS Radio is moving to bigger and better servers. Sometimes little things like this happen. I apologize to you listeners. Michael, I apologize for you for leaving you out in the silence for a while after such a great conversation. As we're coming up to about a quarter till the hour and the closing minutes now that we've reached, we've sort of gone through our break with the technical glitch. Do you have any closing thoughts, Michael, as we come up to the last few minutes of the program about what we've discussed today or how we can help welcoming veterans back in general?
I mean, I definitely like the idea of a ritual for veterans, you know, just something or anything. Like I said, for us, there is nothing. There is no ritual. And, I mean, the things that can happen, the possibilities with a ritual, I mean, it just seems like it would be, you know, so good for the soldiers. So, I mean, I just would love to be able to do something with that for returning veterans. So, I mean, I just love the idea of that, and I thank you guys for giving that to me. And at the same time, if any listeners want to send me an email or anything, my website is masscasualties.com, and I would just love to keep the dialogue going.
Terrific. And just kind of between you, me, and a rather large fence post out there, my guest from the last program, Andrea Baker, the Episcopal Seminarian graduate from West Point, that was with me on the Veterans Day program, and her husband, Brian Baker, the dean of a Trinity Cathedral in Sacramento. Forgive me if I get his rank wrong. I don't speak Episcopalian very well. We're actually looking at later in 2010 doing a public ritual for that, including what I call a belated ritual for those like you, Michael, or like myself many years ago who didn't get one, who may feel it's time for that, or like many Vietnam-era veterans now who were fine. Now PTSD is beginning to rise in older veterans. It may be a product of age, who knows, but it's beginning to happen. So I really appreciate your thoughts. So there are people looking at that, and you would be one of the first people I would look at as a guest if we could get you out here to California when it's warmer. And Daryl, as we come up on these last few minutes, any closing thoughts?
Well, I think that we certainly need exposure, like Michael's concept of exposure therapy or exposure presentations, whatever they might be, in which the true message, the real message, and the full message seems to get across to people when they are sensorially stimulated and impacted by the presence of a returning veteran. And that we just need to do more with that. I think we do need to do more with families, absolutely. We need to do more with the sharing of power and the and not leave the veteran in a power vacuum.
Terrific. Before we get out of here today, before the clock completely runs out, I have a lot of people to thank. First and foremost, Michael, my guest out in Massachusetts way, to thank you not only for your service, thank you for the courage to write this book and the tenacity to write a book. It's not easy writing a book. And I really want to thank you for taking time, evening time out, after finals when you could probably be sleeping or have a life for this. And I want to thank Daryl. I want to thank you for coming in and taking time this afternoon out of your holiday schedule to be with us. And, of course, Will here at the Leland Tea Company for providing space and taking care of us. And my friends from Lower Polk Neighbors, especially my guest on the last show, Chris Shulman, who is my big help in setting stuff up. And, of course, not least, my engineers in Paradise, Seth and Don, In spite of our little glitches, they do a great job of keeping this going and doing the hard work. So all I have to do is sit here and yap with my guests. And so we are getting pretty close to the close here. And I would ask you, as this is our closing show of 2009, 2010 series will begin with a show on relationships with an author who talks about different earth seasons of relationships. It's going to be quite a departure for me to do a program like that, but stay tuned. And then in February, my pastor, who's wrote a book on Revelation from a liberal point of view, will be talking about a liberal, a progressive perspective on the apocryphal literature, and that may be especially timely given the movies that are out now, like 2012. So, again, our clock shows out of time, and I thank you all for listening today, and we're out of here until next year. You have been listening to CI, Confronting the Issues. For comments or questions on this or any CI program, contact us via the web at www.myciradio.com. I'm your host, Risha Ann Young. Join us for the next edition of CI right here on the BBS Radio Network, Channel 2.